You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Thursday, August 27th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, national affairs writer for the Portland Press Herald, Colin Woodward, on his book, American Nations, A History of the 11 Regional Cultures of North America, and what it can tell us about our politics today. Also on the program today, President Obama going for a double as an Iran filibuster, or I should say a filibuster of attempts by Republicans to quash the Iran deal seems to be possibly in reach. Meanwhile, police illicitly using phone tracking in prosecutions of everyday crimes. A crash of right-wing economic myths. Of course, that won't really inhibit the repeating of those myths. And Walmart says, we won't sell semi-automatic weapons anymore. Not necessarily, but not necessarily in the wake of another shooting. That I know, yes, I don't want to hear from ammo sexuals who are telling me that was not a semi-automatic weapon. Of the two reporters live onto, and that story just gets, it's gotten significantly creepier since yesterday when we found out after the show that the perpetrator had actually videotaped himself doing it from his POV. Really messed up stuff. And meanwhile, Guatemala's Accountability Commission, that has been active now for eight years.
2007.
8 years.
8 years.
Is actually working, it appears. All that and more on today's program. Oh, it's UN run.
Yep. It's a UN commission.
But aren't they just looking into Guatemala, or are they looking into other
specifically
countries?
Specifically, it was set up in Guatemala because the institutions were so weak that civil society pushed to basically have the UN set up an agency there to investigate.
When do we get ours?
Yeah, right. Good question.
We're going to go to Colin Woodward in just a moment. Folks, I want to remind you that today this program is sponsored by Harry's.com. We've talked about Harry's quite a bit. And my son actually notices. I mean, I don't know if he didn't notice before because he's 2.5, but he actually notices that my cheeks, on occasion, when I do shave, are actually smooth now. And I have to say, I'm not going to shave more than I do, and everybody knows I only shave like maybe once, maybe twice a week. I try and time it for appearances on television, and sometimes I get a little bit of grief. But I got a Harry's shaving set. It feels very substantial in terms of a shaver. I don't know. I mean, I've never had really a full-on shaver. I've always just bought disposables because I wasn't going to go and pay $1 million or whatever they charge now for. I really don't know. I imagine it's a lot less than $1 million. But with all the packaging that they put around those things, I feel like literally I'm paying more for the sort of the bejeweled case that they put these razors in that you buy at like a, I don't know, a supermarket or at whatever it is, Walgreens or whatever, the Duane Reade. And with Harry's, for $15, a starter kit, you get a razor, which they make at their own Germany, I guess, razor, like steel company in Germany.
Yeah.
Three blades, and you get to choose between their shaving cream or their foaming shaving gel. I've never tried the shaving gel. I'm a cream shaving cream guy. I just like to rub it in. I don't need to know where my place was with the big mound of stuff. And if it's you've never gotten it before, you get $5 off your first purchase with the code Majority Report. So think about that. After you use the code Majority Report, if you've never gotten Harry's before, you get an entire month's of worth of shaving for $10. That's a great deal that you should just try it out once, because you know I have a feeling that you're going to appreciate it. I'm not a big fan of shaving. I'm finding these razors to be great, and the price to be excellent, frankly, even better. I'm cheap. Shipping, totally free. Always free. They cut out the middleman. They pass the savings on to you. Old story, new product. Harry's.com. Go to Harry's.com now. Harry's will give you $5 off if you type in the code Majority Report with your first purchase. That's Harry's, H-A-R-R-Y-S dot and then com. I think everybody understands that. Enter the coupon code Majority Report at checkout. $5 off the starter set, and you will start shaving in a smarter and more pleasant fashion today. We'll be right back with Colin Woodward. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program the national affairs writer for the Portland Press Herald in Maine, author of several books. We're talking about his, I believe his most recent. I know you have one coming out in, I think, spring of next year. American Nations, a history of the 11 regional cultures of North America. Welcome to the program, Colin Woodward.
Well, Thanks so much for having me.
So I want to spend some time talking about the thesis of your book, but then I want to talk about what we can understanding or I guess look at some of the political issues of the day, particularly in terms of what we're seeing with the political race through the framework that you've developed. Now, you basically run through the history of the development of 11 discrete, and I guess 9 or 8.5 of which are specific to the United States, of these regional cultures that have developed from the sort of the beginnings of the history of the United States of America, and how they've developed. Let's go through those quickly, if we could, just to get everybody on the same page. Let's just start, because of my own bias, with Yankeedom.
Sure. I mean, the central thesis is that regionalism is extremely important, but that the regions are misunderstood and miscategorized. And this is a work of history that argues that the regions each are tied to a settlement stream, a mutually exclusive settlement stream that accounts for much of the continent, and that the characteristics of the original competing settlement efforts across the continent, colonization efforts, can still be seen in the characteristics of these regions today, that the different settlement streams sort of laid down the cultural DNA, as it were, and the institutions and assumptions they left behind. And each of 9 of them, including much of the continent, is anchored with a competing colonial project on the eastern or southern rims of what's now the United States. And it's hard to go through all of them really fast in a few minutes, right. But Yankeedom indeed is tied in New England and with the Puritans, and ended up the Puritans and their descendants over a few generations settled essentially, in addition to New England, large parts of upstate New York that had been claimed by Massachusetts and that Massachusetts got deeds to, the Western Reserve of Ohio, which was the Western Reserve of Connecticut and been claimed by Connecticut and therefore was colonized by Connecticut-based land companies. And then a generation later, the initial settlement drives and leaders and attendees of the territorial constitutional conventions and the initial governors and territorial legislators of Michigan were all from either the Western Reserve or the Yankee upstate of New York or New England. And then you move forward, and very similar for Wisconsin and Minnesota and even parts of the Dakotas. And you would have a similar story of settlement streams for each one of the additional original nations down the seaboard, some tied, say, to the Dutch experiment around New York City, others to the Quaker-founded Midlands, which were like both the Dutch and the Quaker-founded Midlands were from the beginning culturally pluralistic, idea of many people from different parts of the world living side by side and perhaps retaining their cultures and no one particular group dominant, which is a very different idea than the Yankee notion of a melting pot where we're sort of, there's a presumed Anglo-Protestant dominant culture that immigrants must assimilate into. Mm-hmm. So those are three, and then you work further down the shore and you end up with a separate cultures in the Chesapeake, tidewater zone of the Eastern Carolinas, the Southern counties of Delaware, the areas around the Chesapeake that were founded by the younger sons of English gentry trying to reproduce the sort of Downton Abbey-like society of the English countryside, very conservative, hierarchical, deference for authority and tradition. Further down, you end up with the Deep South, which was founded out of the English West Indies and was a slave society from the very beginning, with sort of oligarchical tendencies from its early days, and very different from Tidewater and its origins. And then out in the backcountry, in a huge swath of territory, you have Greater Appalachia, founded by settlers from the war-torn parts of the British borderlands, from the lowlands of Scotland, the English marches and Ulster, who brought with them an ethic of individual sovereignty and personal liberty, and that strong desire to maintain, have as few constraints on the individual as possible. And that extended from its original base in southwestern Pennsylvania down the Appalachian chain, but also out along the Ohio and the southern tiers of Ohio and Indiana and Illinois, and on down through the Ozarks and even as far as the hill country of Texas. And then you could go on. There's a Spanish borderlands areas that were founded, not east to west, but from south to north as the northernmost frontier extensions of the New Spain's project in North America. And then other nations in the on the coastal fringe from Monterey, Massachusetts. Monterey, California, all the way through to Juneau, Alaska. The coastal zone was settled by a very different set of people than the far western interior. So that's a quick thumbnail. It's hard to say them all quickly, unfortunately, but that gives readers, listeners, some sense of.
That's right, and we will we'll post a map. I think that I believe it's from Tufts Magazine. That it's just so that people can get a vague notion of that. And one thing I wanted to also ask you about in the context of that map is that, and it may play out, and I'm curious as to how this plays out in terms of. Of politics, but you have the bottom half of Florida. I don't know if the bottom half is really, maybe the bottom third or quarter, and Florida is just massive. But as part of the Spanish Caribbean, and is that simply just because they're really, to the extent that that area has been really populated over the years, it is as much of an extension of the Spanish Caribbean as it is anything else? I mean, short of, I guess, snowbirds?
Well, the central notion in the book is that the origin, and this goes back to a guy named Wilbur Zielinski, who was a cultural geographer, and he was asking the question, you know, how does a new culture get started in a place where the other inhabitants were driven out or where there hadn't been any inhabitants? And he basically argues the first settlement group that succeeds in sort of establishing a self-perpetuating society will have an outsized influence on the future trajectory of that society, even if their numbers were really small and the numbers of the rest of us who came later were larger. They sort of set up what the rest of us assimilate into, the norms and narratives and symbols and values and ideals of a society that make up a dominant culture. And in the case of the southern third of Florida, the northern part was settled from the deep south downwards, the colonization effort, and the sort of overran the original St. Augustine colony that New Spain had and colonized much of Florida. But the southern part remained, was part of the Spanish Caribbean area, which would have had its hub in Havana, coincidentally, but it's not so much the post-Cuban Revolution exiles that affected it. It was that it was always integrated in part of the maritime part of the Spanish-American Empire, which is very different than the interior portions. You know, Havana was this, I did a book on, you know, dealing with the colonial era pirates like Blackbeard and stuff, and at that time, Havana was the sort of hub of the entire Caribbean, where all of the New Spain's treasure ships were headed to transship their stuff, and where the Spanish Navy was based, and the sort of center of their operations. And that's a whole regional culture the book doesn't deal with, because unfortunately I had to put some kind of practical limits on it at some point. And it's a history of 400 years of the sweep of our story and our divisions, and that part of Florida didn't become critical to American politics until, well, arguably the past 20 or 30 years. So it ended up being a peripheral to try to discuss the whole background of it. Well, the same with Hawaii, which would have been in the sort of greater Polynesian zone.
So, I don't want to, again, you know, this is something I think people to do justice to the book, people need to read it. But there's two things that, I mean, I want to just tease out. And you touched on one of them, which was that notion that the original DNA, if you will, of the culture is imprinted by that first group that lands there, because they presumably build institutions which I guess function to assimilate and maintain not necessarily by design, but maybe it is by design, the sort of a certain dispositions towards I guess society, which ultimately translate into sort of a political political choices and actions and perspectives. At one point, you talk about the fault lines between these sort of regional cultures has actually increased in some level since the 60s. Is that right? And explain to us how that happens.
Yeah, and you wouldn't think that that would be the case. I mean, presumably with the rise of mass retailing and mass media and people moving around more and transportation being easier, you would think that the differences between these places would be eroding. But in fact, by almost any measure we have, from political behavior to, you know, values to opinions about things like, you know, the individual rights versus the common good, which side you should err on, what the proper role is between church and state. These divisions seem to be getting bigger. And it's an excellent question as to why. I mean, that's the big question people should have.
Right.
And one of the reasons is that, as a number of studies have shown, people, when they move around, they are self-selecting as they move. You know, statistically speaking, if people have a choice as to where they live, it turns out they tend to be moving places where they feel like they're surrounded by like-minded people. Because each and every one of these, you know, counties and towns, you have the full spectrum of political opinions, right?
Right.
And some people will, you know, in many respects, really like the unexamined, you know, assumptions that are in the air of the particular region they live in. And some people may find it frustrating, and maybe when they have the chance to move, they end up trying to move to an area or a place or a neighborhood where they feel that they're around people who think like they do. And indeed, that is in fact what demographers and social scientists who've been looking at that have discovered is the case. You know, that it's resulting in there being, you know, redder red counties, so to speak, and bluer blue counties, because people, the people who are moving around, statistically speaking, resemble their destinations in political behavior more than they resemble their point of origin. In other words, statistically speaking, the people who are moving are more likely to be different from the people they left behind. So we're self-sorting, which is a countervailing force, which is starting to increase rather than decrease the differences between these regional cultures.
That to me is just so fascinating, because you would like intuitively assume like, oh, there's more mobility, so we're going to become more sort of integrated in some way. But actually, people are just exercising their mobility in such a way to make us more stratified. And so you we have essentially two, I guess, broadly speaking, coalitions, if you will, on one side of the divide, at least from a political standpoint, Yankeedom, the left coast, and New Netherland, which is essentially, you've described, you know, New England and sort of the upper, I guess, the Great Lakes regions, more or less, New York area, and the coast on the left coast, versus the Tidewater, the Deep South, and Appalachia, and then
Interior West, especially now.
Yes, these two sort of, I guess, coalitions, if you will, are vying for the Midlands, El Norte, and the Far West, and so how does it? What is happening? Is that going to always be static, at least in terms of sort of that dynamic, or will places in Midlands and El Norte, and particularly Midlands and the Far West, will they ultimately end up, you know, sort of end up being more like one or the other of those coalitions?
Yeah, well, over time, over the 400-year sweep of our history, the coalitions have tended to shift around. So, you know, it's not inevitable that that would be the makeup of the various coalitions. The thing that seems to be constant since about the, you know, 1810 or so is that the two big superpower blocks, one is usually centered and led effectively by Yankeedom and the other by the Deep South, but their partners keep shifting around. For instance, in the most epic and horrible of our conflicts, the Civil War, Greater Appalachia was actually on the Union side in that,
right,
ultimately during the war, not on the Confederate side. You know, West Virginia seceded from Virginia to stay in the Union. You know, Kentucky never left. Eastern Tennessee tried to secede and had to be put down by force of arms. There was the Free State of Winston and the Appalachian parts of Alabama and so on. So the coalitions absolutely can shift around. What usually, and it's not necessarily like in the past, the parties weren't sorted regionally or even ideologically as sharply as they're becoming now.
Well, that's what I mean. I mean, do you think that we're in a period because we have reached, I mean, on some level, a certain amount of peak mobility, and maybe we haven't, but that, and because we now have sort of more information about these potential destinations where you ultimately go, like, right, like I can choose, like, okay, I live in, you know, in Massachusetts, where am I going to want to move? Well, I can actually understand that place in a way that I couldn't have even 20, 30 years ago because of just, I watch TV, because I can go on Yelp or whatever it is. And, you know, like that we're going to become even more, pure in terms of the way that we sort ourselves. Maybe pure is not the right word.
It's possible. It's certainly a countervailing force to the homogenization effects you would expect from mass media and mass culture and stuff. And it seems like what you're saying is in fact what's been happening in recent decades, because the polarization is growing rather than shrinking. So yes. As to the coalitions, though, who will belong in which coalition, if it's going to be the Democrats and Republicans who are the two main vehicles going forward, neither of them has, you know, a supermajority. That neither of those blocks you described have enough votes in the, you know, Electoral College or a filibuster-proof Senate majority or, you know, a majority in the House. They have to win over the skeptical swing regions whose values and stuff don't, you know, don't accord necessarily with either party's platform right now. So, you know, one or the other political formations would have to significantly modify their strategy to win over some of these more skeptical regions or strip off a weak coalition partner. And that's something I've, you know, sort of argue in the back of the book and in the new book, American Character, which is about the struggle between individual liberty and the common good throughout our history. And those two definitions, those two essential components of freedom, the sort of community's freedom and the individual's freedom, you know, the one has to have them in some sort of equilibrium or balance. Each one of these regions has a different answer as to what that is.
Right.
And to create a supermajority, one of the things the new book explores is what would you need as a set of ideals that would actually deliver you a supermajority? What would that look like based on our historical experience? So it's an excellent question.
Well, I definitely want to hear from you when the book comes out. In the meantime, I know you don't have too much time left here, where you are in terms of in between those two books right now, and look at the phenomena of Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders through that lens, and give me a sense of what occurs to you in that context.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, it's always, you know, the caveat and asterisk, it's always tricky to talk about individuals rather than, you know, large cultural forces. But to the extent one would try to do that.
Right. I look at them as, and that's why I say phenomena, because on one hand, you know, Bernie Sanders represents a fairly distinct, I think, sort of, cultural values in our society, yeah, because he's, you know, associated with being a social Democrat. And on the other hand, Donald Trump, I think you could say the same. You know, this guy is very much associated with the greed is good generation in the 80s, and obviously a certain amount of, I don't know if I'd call it machismo, but you know, with Trumpism and wealth and money, and, you know, on some level, you know, Trump's not even bogged down with some type of like broader policy coherence. He just sort of projects some type of a really cultural values, it seems like.
I mean, there's certainly, their candidacies will certainly play out very differently in different regions, because, like you say, Bernie Sanders is keying on, you know, the socialist and social democratic values that push you over onto the common good or collectivist side of the spectrum. And say Yankeedom, you know, going back to the early Puritans, you know, the Puritans came to create what they thought was a more perfect society, right? A light on the hill. They were going to create the more perfect vision of what they thought God had in mind on earth. And that was a community project that they were going to do through town meetings and their meeting houses and that they would put, if need be, all kinds of inhibitions on individual aspiration and behavior if they threatened the common good of the community. Right, so that there's always been a lot more comfort with the idea that we can build, you know, with trying to create a more perfect society through public institutions that, say, in Greater Appalachia, where it's about maximizing the individual sovereignty and freedom, because, you know, where that culture came from those war-torn borderlands of Lowland Scotland and Northern Ireland, there was no authority you could rely on. You know, there were armies and disorder and chaos. You had to defend your kith and kin yourself. Nothing good was going to become of the arrival of authority. Right. So the path to freedom and security is about the individual's, you know, freedom to act and protect themselves. So you get somebody like Bernie Sanders, and he's going to play much better in a regional culture where, you know, more social values are prioritized, like Yankeedom, into a, in a different way, New Netherland to the left coast, whereas Donald Trump's attitude, you know, the sort of brazen individual and the maximizing of, you know, the flaunting of personal wealth and stuff, that's going to play much better in somewhere like Greater Appalachia, where there's that championing of the individual. Donald Trump himself, the irony is he's sort of a caricature of a cartoon of New Netherland, you know, a society
right.
that was commercial and materialistic and values freedom of inquiry and conscience and certainly speaking your mind. But he, you know, I don't think he'll get very many voters in New Netherland, even if he exhibits a cartoon-like exaggeration of some of the early Dutch values.
And you've also, I mean, and so, you know, I mean, I guess what else is, would you say is playing out? I mean, do you have a sense of like what's playing out too, I guess, within the Republican Party when these, when those values that Trump is representing is sort of right now, and I don't know if it's going to be sustainable long term, but is stomping on what, you know, it has sort of blown out all of the sort of the issue talk on some level. I mean, there's never been, I would argue, a Republican, or I should say in modern times, since probably, you know, since Goldwater, we've never had a Republican who has so dominated the primary field. Maybe this is just this is being a little bit overblown, but he has no ideological coherence to his positions, right? I mean, Social Security, I'm going to attack hedge funders. This is not I don't know if there's ever been a candidate with that sort of array on the Republican side of policy positions. And a, you know, healthy dose of nationalism. I mean, are there any insights that we can gain from what's going on within the Republican Party to this, or is it just too early to tell to see how the Republicans respond across the country?
Well, I mean, he's an outlier in the respect that you point to, in that he doesn't have any sort of philosophical and, you know, coherence or set of ideals that he seems to be following. That's what makes him so particularly unusual. I mean, Goldwater absolutely did have a coherent philosophy, whether you agreed with
right.
it or not. And many, you know, many other candidates expressed one. But yeah, he's something new where it's all based on sort of bravado rather than a sort of program or set of ideals. Now, the fact that that's appealing to a big segment in the Republican Party, you know, is probably not a great thing for the health of the Republic, but it's, there's a lot of, free electrons we've seen out there since the 2008 collapse, especially, that sort of fueled the Tea Party and stuff. That was, you know, there's this definitely a feeling out there in a certain part of the Republican base that politics need to be shaken up and such. The sort of dynamic has been that there's sort of an effort towards a very strong and even radical libertarianism, a sort of, you know, philosophy of how to fix the country that runs into laissez-faire and the, you know, we need to deregulate things and eliminate taxes and social programs, and that will free up the genius, the American spirit. That's a strong argument that is consistent over time within a certain part of the Republican Party, the part that's dominated by the Deep South and in recent decades in Greater Appalachia, that makes that argument. But Trump sort of cuts through, you know, I think he alarms the establishment that adheres to those more laissez-faire values because he's all over the map. They don't know that if he's harnessing a popular dissatisfaction in part of the base, I don't think the Republican establishment knows exactly where he's going to, what direction he's going to channel all that in. That's what makes it sort of new territory.
Right. And
that fight, you know, for Freedom Works and, say, Dick Armey, were trying and succeeded in a lot of ways to channel the frustrations after the 2008 collapse that became the Tea Party, to channel it towards that sort of laissez-faire agenda I just described. And they were largely successful, but not completely. You know, there was the Tea Party movement, all the polling shows they really want to protect Social Security and Medicare, right?
Right,
so
right.
That's not part of that agenda. But Trump is something else entirely, where he's completely, you know, nobody knows where he's going to take it. I think that's what is so extraordinary in looking at what's happening within the GOP today.
And the Social Security and Medicare positions is one that Trump has sort of rolled in to his sort of, I guess, portfolio of positions. And that's what I find just so sort of fascinating about him. So broadly speaking, like, where does this – I mean, taking it back to your thesis, and then, you know, I know you've been very generous with your time, and I appreciate that. What happens next? I mean, does it continue – assuming that people are going to continue to self-select where they're going to move – does this ever resolve itself, or is this just sort of this is almost definitionally what the part of the American political experience is, has been, and will be forever?
Well, if history's any guide, what happens is that you enter a phase where one political formation or another does create a governing supermajority regionally. And, you know, in the past, that didn't have to be within one party. It would be a coalition between one wing of one party and another wing of the other, but it tended to be regionally based. And what will break this period of brinksmanship and polarization, where not only is the country polarized, I mean, it's always been polarized regionally, but to be polarized in such a way where neither bloc has a governing majority and control just keeps shifting back and forth between the two, and, you know, there's not enough strength in Congress to even reliably, you know, raise the debt ceiling. I mean, that's an alarming situation for the, you know, world's sort of arguably the world's leader and superpower to be paralyzed like that in basic functions of its government. So to overcome that will require, like I said, that one formation or the other shift its ideals in order to build a new supermajority. And that's what's happened in the past. There were long stretches where a political body really did have a large governing supermajority that stuck with them, and who did so for decades. So, you know, that would be my guess as to what happens. One side or the other isolates its principal opponent and is able to govern without them. You know, it's a minority that can't do anything about it. So that's been the American experience so far, and presumably will be how we eventually get out of this going forward.
And just to say, I mean, just to tie it in to synthesize this with other stuff that, you know, have been talked about, that's the, I guess, when people talk about the Republican Party becoming increasingly a regional party, and at one point, you know, just sort of demographically speaking, and I think also just sort of, you know, broadly speaking, if they lose the House, which is not going to happen probably in this cycle, but after the next census, that seems to me to be a real potential danger for them as a party. It seems much less probable that would happen to the Democrats at this point.
And the worst thing of all for the Republicans nationally right now about Trump is his alienating of the rapidly growing, you know, of Hispanics, but that's also alienating the El Norte region, which is rapidly growing. And by doing that and sort of having their brand tainted by some of the things he says and his showdown with Jorge Ramos is extremely problematic if you start looking at the electoral map and how these regional cultures overlap, because, you know, if the El Norte portion of Texas starts delivering a strongly, you know, Democratic vote, you can end up with Texas falling into the blue camp with all its electoral votes. And then, you know, the situation looks – there aren't very many pathways to victory on the national stage for Republicans if that happens. So that's probably the thing that I would imagine is giving the greatest ulcers to the Republican establishment now, is about Trump.
And that's why Jeb Bush is insisting it's really about Asians. Colin Woodward.
Well, yeah, for sure. And his candidacy in Florida, I mean, he has to win Florida if he becomes a nominee. And so, yeah, that's exactly why he's pivoting in that direction, for sure.
It's Colin Woodward, author of American Nations, writer for the National Affairs, writer for the Portland Press Herald. Thank you so much for your time today. We'll put a link up to American Nations, A History of the 11 Regional Cultures of North America at our site at majority.fm, and look forward to talking to you when your book comes out, your new book, it comes out in the spring.
Thanks much for your interest.
Thank you. Bye-bye. What happened? Oh, you put it down? Why? Why did you put it down and then make the noise yourself?
Sorry.
You trying to showboat?
What are you doing? You trying to big? You trying to Bigfoot my Skype sound?
I was gonna Bigfoot.
It's really
that's
weird.
What I'm doing. I'm the new Skype sound. Boop boop.
Fascinating stuff. Very fascinating stuff. And really, I mean, the part about, because you would imagine, right, in the intuitive thing to think is like, oh, well, with time, this stuff is going to become more diluted. And I certainly understand, like, you know, I was contemplating the other day, I can't remember what context, you know, what generation American am I? I don't remember, like, I was listening to a radio program and someone said, I'm like a second generation American. And I realized, like, okay, three generations. It's really just, it's my dad, his father, and his father had come over here from more or less Russia in the late 1800s. And I didn't know my grandfather, but that was just because he died young. You know, it's the impact of, there's no doubt in my daily life, I still feel the impact of my grandfather, who I never met, because of what he did to my dad and what my dad did to me. but also in terms of, like, imparting values. I mean, it's not going to get that radically different. Even if you know, we're talking about, like, sort of frameworks in which to view things. And then institutions are set up that, you know, a 50, 60-year-old institution, 70, 100-year-old institution. And then this notion of people, of our increased mobility actually increasing the polarization. Because instead of, you know, being shot out of your small town like a shotgun and going in many different directions, there's a flow, it seems like. And you're going to the same sort of type of psychographic region that you belong. Interesting stuff. And interesting to see how it'll play out in the context of this election that we're now still over a year away from. Ladies and gentlemen, we are going to take a break and head to the fun half of the program. Just a reminder, it is your membership that makes this show possible. Become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. Wait, jointhemajorityreport.com, yes. And justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off your coffee. Are you kidding me? Seriously? It's an amazing deal. And if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Also, leave us a review on iTunes. You know, I read the reviews the other day because Michael was like, before the show, was like, the reviews are really nice. And they are really nice. I start tweeting them out. Like, once a day, we should tweet out from the majority.fm Twitter feed. But the problem is they're probably all more than 140 characters. But then we could put a link to back to the review section. I don't know. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. I think we may have mentioned on the... Well, we'll keep it in the members app. All right, we'll be right back after this. You want to IM me? Pick up the app at majorityapp.com, ladies and gentlemen. See you in the fun half.